Hello, I'm Naomi Stockley, and I'm the Experiences of Care Lead at the Point of Care. In today's podcast, we are going to be talking about community involvement in end-of-life care, and we are so fortunate to have two guests on the podcast today, Libby Salno and Guy Perrier, who will be sharing their stories and thoughts from their wealth of experience on the subject. First of all, welcome to you, Libby. This is the second time Libby has been on the podcast. Libby was joined by our Point of Care Foundation Chair, Richard Smith, for a really interesting discussion on humanising death and dying. So I definitely recommend listening to that episode if today's subject is one that interests you. But for our listeners who don't know you, Libby, would you tell us just a bit about who you are and what kind of work you do in palliative care?
So I'm a palliative care doctor. I work in the community, seeing people who are at the end of life and supporting them and their carers. And I'm also an academic and a researcher interested in understanding different models of how we best care and support for people at these times, and also how society understands these times and responds to them. And in searching for the answers to some of these questions, I've worked at different places around the world, linked with lots of different researchers and practitioners, activists who are really trying to tackle this from lots of different perspectives. And I think that's really the key to how we're going to make sense of these events.
And Guy, it's great to have you for the first time on our podcast. We met last year, didn't we, Guy, when you came on our Foundations in Patient Experience course, which is an open course that we run twice a year on all things patient experience. So we look at co-design, experience data, inclusive involvement and engagement, and lots more. Details of that are on the website. So Guy, it would be great to hear a little bit from you about your story and what you are up to at the moment.
Hello there, and thanks for the invitation. And for your listeners, I can thoroughly recommend the course, so go check it out. So I'm an academic, I'm a doctor, but not a clinical doctor. And I'm currently funded through the National Institute for Health and Care Research on what they call a Knowledge Mobilisation Fellowship. And the topic of the fellowship is encouraging death literacy, which is a term that the Australians have coined around practical know-how, knowledge and skills about knowing your options for end-of-life care and how then to actually put those knowledge and skills into practice, if you like. And I work across the east of England with the six integrated care systems. And in 2021, NHS England formally adopted a series of ambition statements to try and improve palliative and end-of-life. And one of those ambition statements reads, each community is prepared to help. So I'm interested in trying to unpack that and find out what communities ideally need to feel prepared. And if they do feel prepared, what may help them, stimulate, initiate them to step forward.
Fantastic. Thank you, Guy. Libby, I wonder if you could give us an example from your experience of community involvement in end-of-life care that has particularly inspired you.
So I think that I can really focus all of my current work really back to this real key event in my when I was an early trainee, a junior doctor. And I'd always wanted to do something that looked at the kind of social domain really in healthcare. That's what I was always really interested in, the understanding that we're people and society mediates so many of the kind of determinants really that shape our lives and health. So I really wanted to go into something like palliative care to understand what that meant at times of death, dying, grieving and loss, which are universal events. They will happen to everyone within a community. And so I was interested in this and began looking into palliative care as a junior doctor. And I really liked so much of the holistic care in that, but also still found it was a very professionally led response. It was done to you. It was healthcare professionals, you know, brilliantly trained and working in a multidisciplinary team. But still the patients, the carers, the families were really quite passive often in this and a very vulnerable time in their lives. So I was interested in different models of how end-of-life care, death and dying was being kind of managed and supported around the world. And I heard about a project in Kerala that has become, really famous, really, in this field. But back in 2001, it had started as a neighbourhood network in palliative care in a southern state in of Kerala in India, where basically a group of anaesthetists had come together trying to manage cancer pain, and they realised that actually you could manage the pain with medication in the healthcare facility. But when people went home, there was lots of challenges around even continuing access to that pain relief. But actually, that pain was multidimensional, something that was known in palliative care for a long time. But there was so much more: the social, psychological, families often dropping out of school, people unable to keep their families in children in school, and support if the breadwinner was the one who was unwell, families unable to maintain their income, etc. So they decided that this really key, and this is the statement I think that really defines it all, is that life-limiting and chronic illnesses are social challenges with medical components rather than being medical challenges with social components. So they really flipped that on its head. And for me, as a young doctor, trying to think about what models of care best suit, that really switched my whole worldview and really inspired me to think, well, what does this mean? What would this mean in different settings? So I spent and still am very involved with the team there over the past 20 years or so, really understanding how that model has evolved, because it started out as quite a radical model, and has now become the mainstream model for palliative care in Kerala and in many other centers, sites around the world. But my question then, as I came back to the UK and completed my training in palliative care and wanted to understand what this model would look like if we translated the principles, there was a lot of caution, a lot of thinking, well, this is a Kerala model, it works in a specific context. This won't work, for example, in London, a busy urban setting. But I've always been convinced that these are universal issues, experienced differently in different contexts, but actually they cut across society: death, loss, dying, and care. So we interpreted it. We went out to local community groups in East London, and took the ideas of this and just said, what would this mean here in this context? How would we build a community response where it's not professionally led, where we understand the social, the relational domains of this care, and how do we build something that complements existing services? You're not looking to replace. You still want excellent pain relief. You still want a doctor who can come to your home and set up a syringe driver if your nausea is so overwhelming. But you don't only want that. You need so much more. So we started a project called Compassionate Neighbours that takes these ideas and makes it something that works in a UK setting. We started that back in 2014, and now that's running across 11 sites. We've got way over 2,000 volunteers who've been trained as compassionate neighbours, and they're often linked with hospices, but we're looking at extending that further. And we can talk a bit more about kind of what that role means, what a compassionate neighbour or what a compassionate communities approach means in the UK today.
Thank you, Libby. I'm actually interested in terms of what the role of those volunteers is on those sites. What kind of things are they doing?
So we chose the name Compassionate Neighbours really intentionally. We did not want to be looking at training a big cohort of volunteers who are training to a role. And there's a long history of volunteering across different sectors, obviously in the UK, and with the hospice movement is no exception. But often within hospice movements, people and within hospices, the volunteers were quite specific. They would come in to do gardening, hairdressing, or as a retired doctor. So you've got quite a specific role that you're coming into. You're not necessarily bringing your own view of the community, your own view of what might be involved. You're often bringing that role in, which is crucial to the workforce. Often people were bringing some more of their own kind of perspectives and role in, but more under the radar. And with Compassionate Neighbours, this is very specific. This is not about a role within any health or social care organisation. This is around being a good neighbour. And we chose that because everyone knows what that role is, whether you are a good or a bad neighbour or wish to be better. There is a social understanding of what a good neighbour is, and also of the boundaries of the decision making. So people often felt, particularly in East London, when we went out to have these conversations with communities, people were worried about doing the wrong thing, people were worried about getting blamed, people worried about overstepping boundaries, getting in trouble with either kind of health systems or overstepping intimacy and privacy and what that means. How much information should people have? How much are you doing something to other people? How much are you providing a service? So we were really clear to move this, to situate this really outside of service provision. This is not around going and giving company to people, sorting people's issues out. Much as you are when you are a neighbour, you're not in a position where you are responsible for the person sitting next door. You have a social relationship as a social bond, and you have a reciprocal relationship. So the key thing was around people understanding how to be more kind of activated citizens, almost more citizens ready to go out and support, pick up signs. Actually, is this person now unable to get their prescriptions from pharmacy? Are they there post after someone's died? Are they really quite lonely? Have they got no one to talk to? Are they struggling to get certain parts of their practical life done? Can they not walk the dog? You know, what things need to be done? This isn't around medical interventions. So we, rather than having checklists of what you can and can't do, this is discussions around what does it mean to be a good neighbour? And what does it mean to care, support for someone in that role if they are grieving, or if they're caring for their husband who's dying, or if they themselves are dying? So we help people think about what that means rather than a list of do's and do's nots. And then there's a background, a kind of backup of safety. People are in buddy systems, so they always have someone else to support. But there's the team behind who, if they're worried about someone, we talk through what would you do? How would you help them call the GP? And if you're really worried, there's always a backup to kind of support talking through this. But we wanted this to be a normal part, a sustainable part of a street's life, a village life, an apartment block's life, rather than creating a new level of a kind of a professional, really.
Thank you, Libby. And I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on the impact that that has had in those communities, or that you've seen over those years. Guy, how about you? I know that you've got lots of examples that you could potentially draw on of community involvement in end-of-life care. I wonder if there's one or two that you would share with us from your experience.
Yeah, so there's quite a few stories I could draw on, but there's two that spring to mind just on the back of what Libby's just said. So my PhD was not related to palliative and end-of-life care. It was to do with complex systems. I work a lot with interface design. So when I started to read more about demographic change and challenges to health and care workforce, and also this ambition for more community involvement, I saw, okay, so what's the relationship going to be between this sort of dichotomy between statutory services and community involvement? And then I started to read more, and I found out about the Anne Robson Trust. So this is a formal charity that work in acute settings, and the strapline of the charity is no one should die alone. And I would say, you know, with a caveat, unless they want to, of course. And I volunteer as a butterfly. And what that means is that on my shift, I have a 2-hour shift, and I go to the coordinator, and they give me a list of about 5 or 6 people that I might want to try and go and see. And they're on a range of wards in the hospital. And I go up to the ward sister, and I tell who I've come to see, and I generally sit with them. And one example springs to mind of a lady that was visiting my area of Norfolk on holiday, and she'd fallen ill, and she asked me to write a letter to her 4 grandchildren. And so I sat there, and we went through each one of them one by one, and it was her pearls of wisdom of what she felt she'd learnt in her life and what her recommendations for each of them were for the future. And I then passed on my letter to the ward sister, and it got sent to the necessary recipients. And I found out the next day that essentially I was the last person that she spoke to before she died. And so it was just a sense of feeling that I played a part, not just in the family's life, but you know, Libby was talking about this reciprocal benefit. I was really happy with what had just happened. I felt privileged around it. So that's one thing that sticks in my mind. And the other example I'd use is that we received a little bit of funding from when Boris Johnson, it seems like a long time ago now, when Boris Johnson repurposed some money for hospices. And we don't have a great deal of hospices in my area of Norfolk, so we got a chance to apply for some of the funding. And we formed what we called a citizen-led learning network, or a citizen-led community of practice is another name for it. And through the course of our working together, we worked with the volunteer centre, and we heard that there was a gentleman dying in hospital who, according to his advanced care plan, he wanted to die at home. The discharge team had sent people round to his house to assess it, And they came back and says that his electrics and the plumbing wouldn't support the installation of a hospital bed. So unfortunately, that was regarded as a failed discharge. Well, somehow the volunteer centre got to hear about this, and our group managed to mobilise a plumber and an electrician the same day. And they took a nominal fee because they knew what it was for. And then the message went back to the hospital to send out the discharge team again to assess the house. And lo and behold, it was safe for him to be discharged home, and he died in his place of preference with his wife nearby. And I guess the message that why I felt it was important, because it's unrealistic for a plumber and an electrician to be on a busy discharge nurse's call sheet. However, thinking about this idea of interface, one call to a volunteer centre in this case allowed us to do what we actually wanted to do.
What a brilliant example, and one that sort of illustrates how our systems can just work in isolation. They don't speak to one another, even though it could make all the difference for people who are towards the end of their life. I know, Guy, that you're really passionate about end-of-life care and particularly community involvement in end-of-life care. And I wonder if you can tell us a bit about what it is that drives you to do this work that, let's be honest, lots of us would probably shy away from.
What drives me is my upbringing, really. I have family connections. When my grandmother was a head matron up north, she used to receive referrals for people who were dying in the local community. And she was the one who was called, so much so she used to receive people where she lived. So my mum grew up with three women dying in the house throughout her teens. And the reason why I say that is that it's only one generation where things have changed so dramatically. And I can understand why, because it's potentially upsetting for us to think about end of life and dying. But at the same time, we've kind of let it happen. So it's easy for us to say that somehow services are there, and they've instigated this change. But I guess we haven't necessarily been as active as we could be. As a consequence of some of the conversations, and certainly no nonsense conversations, I described them in my household growing up, I feel as though that there's an opportunity to spread some more awareness around this topic, because my background is psychology, and I'm the first person to say that it's in our own advantage, it's in our own interest to actually try to consider these topics more to try and prevent unnecessary suffering, which is one of the premises of palliative care.
Thank you, Guy. And Libby, I could see you nodding as Guy was talking about the change that we've seen over just one generation. I wonder what your reflections are on the impact that community involvement on end-of-life care can potentially have on people who are approaching the end of their life.
Yeah, there's a real sense that things have become unbalanced, really, with how things are currently, with the balance between community, family, kind of societal understanding, narratives, and support around death, dying, and grieving, and then the professional or institutional models of care that we have now. And I think one of the things that always surprises me when we think about how we're managing death, dying, and caring is that these are universal issues. They will happen to every single person in society multiple different times, caring, bereavement, and of course our own eventual deaths. And these are difficult things to think about. They are not easy, they are upsetting, they're challenging, and the idea of losing people or your own idea of your own existential mortality, not being yourself, these are really difficult things to grasp, which is why they're the topics of art, poetry, music, religion. That's why they are so difficult. But not talking about it, not thinking about it, not recognizing their presence in all our lives and part of our human condition only serves to make it more shocking and harder when they do inevitably, as they will, come into our lives. And similarly to Guy, as with all of us, really, we're made up of our early years, often different experiences that have shaped us. And I had a significant early bereavement as a child, and so was forced to think about these things very early on. And I really saw, I think, with a child's eyes, you often see things that adults don't. People shrunk away from this. They did not want to talk about it. I was made to almost feel a bit embarrassed about this, that people couldn't deal with the sadness really that they saw associated with this. And that it just got me thinking. I reflected, I thought a lot about this, and I think it's meant that I'm not worried or shy of having these big conversations and holding these big emotions. I think they're really crucial. And I think everyone at some point when they're faced with it realizes this. Often, if you, for whatever reason, had your experiences slightly earlier, it shapes your view on it. And but many people who I care for, who I support at home, say, I wish I'd had the chance to do X, Y, Z. And it's too late now to have, this conversation. I wish I'd known this. And a lot of the work that I do with carers particularly is often going back, looking at at their parents' death, maybe if they're caring for a husband or wife. It now makes sense as they look back to understand what was happening at the time. And it's only really, I think, when you begin creating a space for these big emotions, sad, complex, but also beautiful, intimate, and peaceful moments, do you begin creating a space for them in society and communities and families. And then, and this is where the upstream part is really crucial, you're then able to think about the future, make decisions about your own wishes, or have, as Guy said, robust conversations within your family, within your community to say, okay, this is going to happen. It's going to be difficult potentially, but how can we make it the best it can be? Because I certainly have seen that by not talking about it and by letting death, dying, and caregiving become so unfamiliar, it just magnifies the challenge when it does suddenly hit you, because it then suddenly you're staring at it in close quarters with very little time to have thought and reflected about it.
Absolutely. And that makes me think then, what kind of impact does it have? So, thinking about the compassionate neighbours, for example, have you seen some of the impact that that has when people move away from thinking about death and dying and grief as a purely medical thing and more towards a responsibility that we have as a whole community? What difference does it make?
A good question. So I explored and evaluated the Compassionate Neighbours Project as part of my PhD a number of years ago now. And what I was expecting to see is that starting a project like this would really improve experiences for people who were at the end of life, people who were socially isolated, people were feeling disconnected or frightened with this, huge event, life event happening to them. And that did happen. People were describing being connected, feeling supported, and taking part in this new relationship was really important to them. But what I wasn't expecting to see was the impact on the people, the volunteers, the compassionate neighbors who'd come forward. And I don't think they were expecting the huge impact it had on their lives. So we saw some people who had been carers for example, for a disabled child, and the parent had really lost connection with the rest of his social network, his career, etc. And he came in to start volunteering and had a real epiphany, I think, of understanding his value in society, his value, and what he could give to someone. And crucially, what we saw is that it was about this reciprocal relationship between, it wasn't about someone coming in to give support or give care or give compassion or give friendship to someone. And it wasn't only that the volunteer was going there to feel better and, feel they've done good to society and leave. It was the reciprocal relationship between both the person who was at the end of life and the person who was supporting them. But it wasn't that it was a one-way solution. And so that what we saw is the networks were being created quite independent often of the support of people at the end of life, but networks in the community where people were able to have conversations and support each other in the future. And we saw during one of the Compassionate Neighbours networks, one person fell ill, was diagnosed with cancer during that. And actually, the network around them then supported this person who was quite isolated otherwise, went to outpatient appointments, took them in and out for radiotherapy, and actually became their network. So it's this sense that we should not assume and hold positions too strongly. The person who is at the end of life who's dying, another person who is giving compassion or giving support. Actually, we're all on different parts of life's journey. These are universal events. We will face them frequently and multiple in different ways. So how can we understand that actually all of us are just beginning to create a space to understand these events, how we personally respond, how our community around us responds, and how society responds, rather than thinking, I'm out here to give support to this person, which is how it is within professional areas. You don't come in thinking, okay, well, when are you going to look after me? It's time that you come in to give that. And I think the really crucial, another just one key little snippet of a a story that really resonated with me. There's was a community action charity in Newham in East London that was looking at ways to make societies more supportive of people who are growing older, age-friendly societies. And they said one of the things that we should do is get rid of food banks, really punchy titles. And like, right, what's that for? And they said that food banks, and we should get rid of befriending movements. These are the two, because they're both very downstream. So you ideally want to live in a society where you don't need food banks. These are not ideal parts of society. They are driven out of desperation, of people needing urgent solution to food. You ideally would have a society that can sustain everyone's affordability and need for food. Similarly with befriending movements, we should be aiming towards a society where people don't need to be referred in for kind of an hour of connection with someone. That should be something that exists within the fabric of a society. And so ideally we should be working to get rid of all befriending movements, get rid of all food banks, where you have societies that understand the needs and can support them in a sustainable way. And that really, I was writing my PhD at that point, and I really thought what a difference that makes. And I think that draws a very helpful distinction between befriending movements and compassionate communities movements. Befriending movements are professional, run by volunteer, delivered by volunteers, but professional responses to social isolation and loneliness, and can be really helpful. And often brilliant friendships come from that, but often they're time limited. You can't speak much about yourself. You withdraw at the end of that kind of service intervention. Compassionate communities are ways of reframing the way people connect, specifically around death, dying, and loss, and times of difficulty, but they are sustainable. They do not end. Compassionate neighbours does not have an end. So when people are connected in, it's for as long as they wish to both be connected. And it's about sustainable relationships rather than delivering a service.
Thank you, Libby. Guy, I wonder if those ideas of sustainable relationships and reciprocal relationships, as Libby's talked about, as well as the thinking about what's happening upstream rather than downstream, resonates with your experiences and the work that you've been doing.
Absolutely. So I'll just reflect on the impact part just briefly, if that's okay, because your question reminded me of something that happened to our family just last year. And the impact for me, again, comes back to my psychological bias in this idea of preparation. So much of our human psychology is factored into prospective thinking. Our whole motor system is feed forward. Right. We like to anticipate what's on the horizon. So I have four children, and I had four opportunities for NCT classes, four opportunities to know what's on the horizon. Whereas transferred to the end of life, we currently have nothing to prepare us, which I find slightly shocking in a way. There's a lack of parity of esteem, if you like, between the two. So my father-in-law was poorly for many years. He had had six heart attacks. And we honestly thought that it was going to be his heart that would get him. But it just so happened that he had an admission to hospital, and they found spots on his liver. But that's an indication of a secondary cancer. And he went home because that was according to his preference. He wanted to die at home. And at one point, my mother-in-law was just astonishing at the care she was able to provide, but it was exhausting. And as my wife said, after the event, you don't know what you need to know until you're exhausted and stressed out. There was no opportunities, no advice drip fed to her or anything to enable her to prepare. It just so happened that my mother-in-law phoned me to say that his breathing had changed. And then we sought advice over this. And we quickly managed to mobilize the rest of the family. I wasn't aware of the term at the time, but they call it chain stoking. I'm sure Libby may be able to expand on this. But it's a surefire indicator that he's entered a new phase, if you like. But by being able to diagnose and rally the troops, so to speak, we all managed to get round the house, and we could say our last goodbyes, if you like. You know, our thank yous, I love yous, all those sorts of things that go hand in hand with dying. And I just reflect now is that without that ability to notice that step change and what was happening, that change in breathing, if we had left it, either it triggered an admission to hospital, which he didn't want. You know, my mother-in-law could have easily phoned 999. It enabled the family to come together. which has then completely transformed their whole experience of bereavement.
Thank you for sharing that, Guy. And I wonder if for you then, one of the things that you would want to change about end-of-life care in the UK might be around death literacy, people understanding these stages. You know, is there, what's your big thing? You both got big thumbs up, right? Our listeners can't see that, but is that the thing? Would you say if you were to pick something, if you could wave a magic wand, what would be the one thing that you would love to change about end-of-life care and how it's done at the moment in our society?
I have to say, with a slight caveat, I'm not the biggest fan of the term death literacy. It could be more inclusive, because if you think of the term literacy, you also think of illiteracy. And this is not a test that someone needs to pass or fail or have any kind of educational element to it. I'd regard this as just a need for awareness. Everybody needs to have it. I like the Stoic principle of memento mori, where they would, on a daily practice, would remind themselves that they're going to die. And that's not to be morbid, but through appreciating death, you also maximize the life you have. I know a colleague of Libby's, Sheldon Solomon, he wrote a book called The Worm at the Core. And his work suggests that actually our existential fear of death dictates how we shop, how we vote. It's at the background so much. So if I were to wave at this magic wand, I would like to normalize our approach to holding conversation. And by doing that, I think that we will be more in a position for supporting each other and putting community involvement in palliative and end-of-life care more in this idea of health promotion rather than this reaction to all hands on deck. There's a high intensity issue that needs to be solved.
And Libby, how about you? If you had that magic wand, would it be something similar for you or different?
I think the awareness and, for want, yeah, want of a better term, the kind of literacy, the death literacy, the ability to understand and shift what's happening is crucial. And I definitely see in my clinical practice, going and seeing people at home, people are unprepared and unfamiliar with these events that are, as we've said, universal events. Everyone will encounter these. But the shift to professionalized and institutional care has really stripped people of the opportunity. Often people don't see someone dying till much later in life, which is an achievement of modern public health services, that people are dying later and not dying of so many preventable diseases. I mean, inequity still exists to mean that is not the case across, but broadly life expectancy is increasing. But it does mean that when people die, often they die in institutions, in care homes, in hospitals. People don't know what shifts in breathing means, how to reposition someone, how to care for someone's mouth and skin. And I spend such a huge amount of time talking people through this. And it's very empowering giving people this knowledge, because it means you don't have to call an ambulance if you are worried about a shift in someone's breathing, like Guy describes. And that, I spend so much time doing that, but I'm kind of one person doing this one at a time. And so there's something really urgent, I think, that we need across our society to understand what this means individually. Obviously, everyone will have a different, you know, everyone's journey is different, much like a birth. You can't predict that, but there are certain crucial elements of that journey that are universal and that need to be shared. So I think if we could improve this understanding and share that on a public health level, a health promotion level, these are life events that all of us must be prepared for, both in terms of making a will and, you know, making advanced decisions or advanced care planning, but also in terms of how are the kind of practical things to support people? What do I need to know? Because the policy push is for dying in a place of preference, and for the majority of people who are surveyed when well, people want to be at home. So what needs to then follow is support around that, not only with 24-hour district nurses, community palliative care service, GPs who are able to see, but actually community awareness, community knowledge, community empowerment to really say, I know what these skills mean, these signs mean, I know how I then respond. And that's a job that needs to be supported. And that's really what death literacy and compassionate communities are trying to bring.
Thank you, Libby. Guy, I know you've trained as an end-of-life doula. I think that's what it's called, isn't it? Can you tell us what led you to do that, and perhaps a little bit about what the role involves and what difference you think it makes to people?
I think what led me to train was this idea of interface. And training as an end-of-life doula means that you become far more equipped to be knowledgeable about the current health and care system around death and dying, and also opportunities of where a non-clinical member of the public can become involved. So I would see this as a middle person, if you like. And what I've observed of how it can make a difference is, well, in my case, down the pub. I would share my knowledge of these events and drip feed certain information to friends. And we think about the ripple effect. And that's what we're really trying to achieve, is to support more people with this death literacy knowledge that we know can make so much of a difference when people feel more prepared about what to expect. And I see it especially with the pressures that the health and care system are under. So we've got a rising demand for end-of-life care. We've got challenges to workforce at the moment. And certainly for the members of staff who are in work, they've got workload concerns. So this coming back to the original discussion around the ambitions framework that NHS England adopted, each community is prepared to help. I mean, it's very, very necessary that members of the public take some responsibility in end-of-life care. And so end-of-life doulas in that context are kind of trying to push that agenda, but from a non-specialized perspective. We don't do any clinical work. This is just all non-clinical elements. And thinking about a community nurse visiting someone at home, they may have a fixed amount of time that they can spend with that person or family. But doulas, they either operate as volunteers, or some also ask for some payment, but they have time on their hands. And when you're dealing with end-of-life care, having time is an essential component. But the doula element is a part of the puzzle. It's by no means it's a complete answer, but it's one of these ones where sort of slightly more educated members of the public, but all in non-clinical parts of care.
Thank you, Guy. Finally, I'll come to you, Libby, for any reflections on that, any thoughts on what for you might be the kind of most important things that people could do to improve how we think about and do end-of-life care.
Yeah, I think the first is to recognize, get over that. The biggest hurdle is recognizing that this at some point will happen to us all and to our family. And that is, I think that's one of the main barriers, really. It's painful. I don't want to think about that personally, although I spend my professional life building this. That is really hard. And I think we must, in the kind of movement to push these discussions, we must never forget how hard and upsetting this is, because it really is. And I think that's the first thing to have to recognize. But then the next thing is to have conversations about wishes and plans. And the advanced care planning movement is very big. And there's lots of different documents and tools from GPs or from hospices who can support those discussion processes and record them. And there are lots of different projects that are building in different areas. So a lot of local hospices or other hospitals have got opportunities to connect, to volunteer. There's lots of different podcasts and webinars on, and there are various projects going around to look at essentially building like an NCT for end of life. So Scotland's much more advanced than us in this, but they're called end of life skills for everyone, or in Europe they're being described as last aid courses rather than first aid courses, communities where people can sign up and just go to learn what happens around this ahead of time. So I think there's lots of different opportunities, but the first thing is just switching on almost that radar, and to think, I'm not going to cross the road and not pop into that house because, they probably want to be left alone because they've got someone who's, seriously ill there. Just knock on the door and ask if there's anything you can do, and begin being more aware and doing that in your own networks, and then maybe reach out to look at where else you could develop some more kind of specific skills.
Thank you, Libby. Guy.
Just building on something that Libby just said, if your listeners haven't had a chance to read Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, I'd thoroughly encourage them to do so. In the book, he talks about four key questions that either clinicians or anyone could ask. And if anyone is struggling to engage with the idea of what they might want in terms of end-of-life care, Gawande flips it round and says to consider things that you don't want. And in my experience, when I ask people some things about what they want, sometimes they can feel somewhat paralyzed by going, "Well, I don't know." And I say, "Well, flip it around, tell me what you don't want." And then suddenly lots of things come out. So by listing things that you don't want, hopefully at least you can initiate some kind of advance in the conversation to refine down things that you might want. It's also a familiar response when I speak to my friends who've tried to engage their parents or, grandparents about some of their preferences. They get closed down. And my mentor, Hermione Elliott, who leads the Living Well, Dying Well organization, she would describe this as an act of love. And usually parents or grandparents would have their offspring in those sorts of, descriptions. And I reflect on my experiences as a butterfly for the Anne Robson Trust. I often see people who are within days or hours of dying, and the vast majority are non-communicative by that stage. So when we're trying to encourage families to become more aware of what people want within their own unit, it's to their advantage because it might be the case that the person who is approaching the end of life is actually non-communicative and won't be able to speak for themselves. So if you're asked to advocate on their behalf, it's unfortunate for people to look back and go, "I'm not sure if that's what they would have wanted." And this what comes out of this idea of an act of love. I'd say to my mum, "Well, look, mum, I may be speaking on your behalf. I prefer it if I could say that with confidence."
Thank you both so much for coming on the podcast to talk to us. That's all we've got time for today, but it has been fascinating to talk to you, and I wish you both the very best in the work that you're doing.